Welcome to Spider on the Web 25 and the book reviews I promised of two SF novels by non-SF writers, Ravi Zabor's The Bear Comes Home and Cormac McCarthy's The Road. Mr. Zabor's book has also been called a jazz novel, but it easily transcends that or any other genre, so I'm going to open up with some jazz that does just that. The famous opening tune from Ornette Coleman's landmark 1959 album The Shape of Jazz to Come, a thumb in the eye of the entire jazz establishment, which managed to outrage even bebop guys. This isn't the original album track, which I don't have permission to use, but a piece of a live version from 20 years ago by Charlie Hayden's Quartet West. That's appropriate, too, because in a little while, Charlie and Ornette will both be appearing as characters in Raffi Zabor's book. Here's Charlie with Branford Marsalis, Kenny Kirkland, and Billy Higgins tackling a 50-year-old classic that still has the power to startle, Lonely Woman.
Thank you. Seeing the Hornet was like the Bebop days all over again, because he was one of these cats who was... What he was putting down was so strange, nobody could figure out whether they dug it or not. Not even in jazz, man. I mean, this is a place that could handle Thelonious Monk, but Hornet weirded them out a little bit. He had his thing called harmelotics, and some folks dug it and some didn't. A modern jazz quartet flipped for him. Lionel Hampton jumped up and down and wanted to perform with him. Leonard Bernstein dug him and offered encouragement. On the other hand, not everybody dug it. Of all people, Miles Davis, himself one weird son of a bitch, famously declared that Ornette Coleman was all screwed up inside, although he later took it back. And Roy Eldridge, the guy who used to blow with Billie Holiday, said, I listened to him all kinds of ways. I listened to him high, and I listened to him cold sober. I even played with him. I think he's a jiving baby. Well, the verdict of history is in, because it turns out that what Ornette was putting down really was the shape of jazz to come, because the cat copped a Pulitzer Prize last year, if you can dig that. A Pulitzer Prize, I love it. That'll look real nice on the shelf right next to his Grammy Lifetime Achievement Award, and I believe I heard he's nominated for Best Instrumental Album Grammy this year. Anyway, we are now going to meet Ornette Coleman as a fictional character in the most exciting science fiction novel I've read in years. And as I said earlier, if he heard me say that, the author might turn pale. I'm quite certain that his publishers would feel the blood drain from their head and would reach for their revolvers. The book is by Rafi Zabor. It is called The Bear Comes Home. Now, it's a first novel, but on the other hand, it's the first novel that won the Pen Faulkner Award. That should give you a clue. I'm going to, with, I hope his forgiveness, I'm going to read a couple of short segments from The Bear Comes Home, because the book just flips me out, and I've been reading parts of it aloud to my wife, and I want to read some to you. To set you up as briefly as I can, The Bear Comes Home is about the greatest musician of his generation, the next John Coltrane, the next guy who all music thereafter will be divided into before him and after him. We're talking about a giant, and we get to watch his talent mature and flower in the course of this book. He is a saxophone player, just like John Coltrane. He's even more ambitious, and he has this one personal quirk. He's a bear with opposable thumbs, and he's sentient and can not only talk, he can quote Blake and Hopkins, but he blows jazz saxophone. And aside from that, the book is a perfectly straightforward and natural little novel about a great composer. It happens to include some of the best writing I have ever read in my life on what it is like to perform live music for an audience. I'm going to take you now into a live performance in which the bear is on stage in Greenwich Village in one of his early gigs. It's a problem for the bear performing, you know? You go up there on stage and start to blow, and you're a bear. If somebody freaks and calls the heat, they're going to come and put a chain through the ring in your nose and drag you off to the zoo, and that's a bummer. But he's taking a chance, and he's up on stage in the village playing along with the incredible art ensemble of Chicago, Lester Bowie, the late, great Lester Bowie, and his madman friends. The bear is, as I said, a little paranoid and uptight, but Lester Bowie reassures him. We're overdoing the costume shit tonight. You'll be lucky if anyone even notices you, Bowie said. And he might have been right. Bassist Malachi Favors had painted his face white and wore tribal-style robes of silver lamé. Joseph Jarman had topped off his cloaks and war paint with a pair of fluffy pink bunny ears. Drummer Don Moyer was wearing approximately Dogon regalia. Roscoe Mitchell, in street clothes and black cotton watch cap, merely nodded high. The bear wore what seemed to be his regulation music costume of raincoat, baggy pants, and wide-brim hat. "And dig this," Bowie said, showing him the gun, a small black automatic lying on the palm of his hand. "The piece of resistance. Ought to scare off intruders, right? Sometimes I like to shoot it off at the end of a trumpet solo. Blanks, of course, but it also takes flare cartridges and tear gas. I bought them along in case of trouble. When I bought the thing, I wanted to see what the flares were like, and I damn near set fire to the house." Malachi Favors finished applying bright red lipstick and smiled out of the mirror at the bear. "I'm interested to hear how you play," he said. "I'm sure, from what Lester tells me, I will be delighted." Roscoe Mitchell nodded again and again said, "Hi." In the event, the music had been interesting. After standing with the band in silence facing east, a nice moment, actually, an effective tune-up, things had begun in a rumor of gongs and bird calls, and the bear had stayed out of it, a few stray notes accepted. Standing at his base, Malachi Favors began muttering into a bullhorn. Lester was breathing hoarsely in and out of his horn, and something in these gathering strands of music caught on his fur. And before he knew it, he was involved in a converse of whispers with Roscoe Mitchell on the other alto, while Joseph Jarman roamed the gong world behind him, occasionally punctuating the groundswell with a bicycle horn. Now, the Bear had never considered himself a flat-out free atonal player. He hoped he sounded like himself, though it was pretty obvious he came out of Bird, Ornette, and Jackie McLean. But as he and Roscoe tangled further and drums and bass came up under them like some thickening storm, and Jarman raised a rattle of bells and chimes before the rising wind, in a matter of minutes the Bear was involved in successive tumults of free blow with Roscoe's pretty much atonal alto, and the band's whole sound rose up in a wave. When the crescendo subsided, the rest of the night was blown clear of obstruction, and the Bear went into it happily and without much worry. The audience, which applauded pretty much on schedule after each of the music's episodes, didn't bother him either. There was a long sort of blues, the rhythm section solid. Malachi Favors' bass huge and warm without, the Bear noticed in some surprise, the benefit of amplification. The Bear had some fun with Bowie, trading choruses, then drifting into some less marked out call and response. There was a long percussion jam in which he crossed the stage, grabbed a mallet, and whomped away at a big bass drum, and then someone called Jarman's impossibly up-tempo Coltrane tribute, Oneida Ruth, and all the horn players blew their brains out in succession. Bowie played last, pulled out his pistol at the end of his outing, and emptied his clip of blanks into the lights. So far so good, thought the Bear, as he squeezed tight on the reed and blew out a skirl of multiphonics. But then Bowie, looking as if he'd gone mad for all the scientific sobriety of his lab coat, reached into his pocket, loaded another clip into the automatic, and fired another brace of blanks into the avid crowded tables of the nightclub, yelling, "Bang, bang, bang, motherfuckers!" And a busload of tourists at a row of tables near the front, some tour director must have sent them to see the art ensemble by mistake or for laughs, who had been only mildly alarmed at the first shots and the presence of what seemed to be an actual bear on stage, now went into blind panic, flinging the chairs aside and bolting through the tightly packed crowd for the exit. Their panic spread through the club, no one sure what had happened or what had not, and it pretty much cleared the house. The band retired backstage laughing, Jarman threatening to kill Lester Bowie twice, and the Bear stood there on stage looking through pistol smoke. He heard Jones calling from the club's front door. But he also saw a lone figure seated at a table, and the Bear's jaw dropped in deference. It was Ornette Coleman, the master. He made me. The Bear stepped down from the stage through the remaining gun smoke and walked to Ornette's table. Ornette was wearing a black silk suit, and he seemed untroubled by the gunshots and the emptying of the club. He smiled up at the Bear.
"That was interesting," Ornette said, in a faraway, gentle voice. "But what I wonder, even though you play 1,000 times better than I ever could, was how can you play so much like a human person? What I would like to know is, do you transpose from bear to human? And if so, why do you do it? Because if I played with you, what I'd like is for you to play bear without transposing, and I could play like me, even if I don't know if that says man, and then we could see what the total added up to if no one did the adding, you know?"
Even though he felt the hemispheres of his brain crossing, the Bear was sure Ornette was right. Why did he transpose? Why was he so weak as to want to assimilate?
"You're right," he told Ornette redundantly.
"You see," Ornette told him, "I think you play quadrupedally. So what would a quadrupedal tone be if you didn't transpose it to two-footed music? That would be the really interesting thing. By the way," he said, "I wouldn't worry about the audience leaving. They used to walk out on me all the time."
"Well, I don't want to spoil anything for you, but things don't go too well for the Bear. He ends up spending some time in the joint, where he does some real hard time. But eventually things look up for him, and he finds himself in a band with his friend Billy Hart, a young piano player that everybody says is just a genius named Bobby Hatwell, and unbelievably Charlie Hayden on the bass." Let's take it up as the Bear walks into the studio. As the Bear shoved his way through the control room doorway, he took in the scene as if scouting the place for danger. None was visible. A thin, alert-looking guy in a plaid shirt and a neat haircut and beard was working a slider on a control panel that looked like it could pilot the Starship Enterprise, and the sound of Charlie Hayden playing his bass came through the enormous speakers set into the wall above the picture window that opened out on the playing space. The Bear stooped to look through this window, it was set a couple steps lower than the control panel, into the studio, and saw Charlie Hayden's back bent over his instrument,
a French bass, the bear understood, from the late 18th century. He saw Billy's drum set in an annex past Hayden on the other side of the big piney woods asymmetrically octagonal room. There was so much raw-cut wood the bear could smell it clearly enough to know it wasn't all pine. He distinguished at least two distinct other saps, but could not name them with all that polyurethane in the way, besides which he was a city bear and did not know the names of enough trees. He looked out there for Billy, but the drummer was nowhere to be seen. "I'm James," said the engineer, looking up from the control board. "I'm getting some levels."
"Hi," said the bear. "So am I."
He felt sufficiently in place now to hear what Hayden was doing. The bassist cycled his way down a series of triple stops, the root in perfect tune, and the higher notes slid infinitesimally sharp to lend his cording a questing tone. When Hayden reached the bottom of the cycle, he cut loose one of his core-of-the-earth tones from the bottom of the bass and bent it with some powerful fingerwork so that the note arched up into beauty and pretty much devastated the bear's by now wholly attentive heart. The bear couldn't quite believe he was really going to get to play with this guy.
"Hey, man,"
Hayden's voice came at him from the speakers. The bear opened his eyes to see Hayden smiling at him from behind the glass.
"Killed anyone yet today?"
"It's early," said the bear.
"What?"
"Hold on, I'll open a mic for you," said James from his emplacement. "Nah," said the bear, pulled open the heavy control room door, and ambled into the studio proper. Hayden was laying his bass gently down on its side, cushioning it on a rectangle of carpet. The bassist looked up at him and smiled. The bear had seen a lot of people walk up to him over the years, but none of them had done it quite like Charlie Hayden. Usually, especially on the first few tries, there was something freaked out about them, whether it was covered by irony or bravado or not. But Hayden, as at the rehearsal the other day, walked up to him more simply than any other human being ever had, a social smile softening his features and a look of interest in his eyes. Hayden put his hand out, and the bear took it firmly in his paw.
"It's really great to see you, man," Hayden said in his wavering tenor.
"I ain't a man," the bear began to say his usual riff, but then dropped it. "Well, it's good to be seen. I mean, it's good to see you too, both, whatever."
Hayden was one of the few people he had met who had the power to disarm him more or less completely. The prelims done, Hayden allowed a devilish grin to break out and play across his features.
"I play with a lot of animals, man, but this is really a first."
The bear joined him in a laugh without thinking twice. "Our first duet." Suddenly Hayden was a trifle anxious.
"I didn't mean that in an offensive way."
"No, it's cool," the bear told him. "I got it. I know what you meant."
"I was afraid of having made what might be thought of as a humanist statement."
The bear had to chuckle.
"That's the first time I've ever heard the word used in that sense," he said.
"Well, it shouldn't be the last."
Hayden nodded yes with a certain meditative seriousness.
"Stick 'em up,"
said a voice from behind the bear, and something like a gun barrel poked him in the back.
"Billy," said the bear, "if I didn't recognize your voice, I might have spun around and taken your head off. You got to be careful around me just now. I'm in no mood for another arrest. What's that in my back, the butt end of a drumstick?"
"Yeah,"
said Billy, coming around front to say hello.
"I wasn't thinking. Sorry, bear. How you feeling today?"
"Some days you eat the bear told him, "and some days the bear eats you."
Billy shook his head.
"I could think about that all week and not know what you could possibly mean by that."
"I'm a little wired. Where's Bobby Hatwell?"
"Here."
The bear had to blink at the piano player. First he had not been there, then he was. Where had he come from?
"First there is no Hatwell, then there is," he said. "Nice trick. How you feeling?"
"I'm a little wired,"
the piano player said, like an echo delay effect. Rahim Bobby Hatwell was a small, medium dark brown guy in his 20s with a bullet head, small ears tucked tight to his temples, a delicate mouth, an articulated Ethiopian nose with arched nostrils, and dark Persian almond eyes that looked right at the bear the way most people's eyes did not. He was well-muscled, highly articulated forearms coming out from under the pushed-up sleeves of his charcoal gray cotton sweater. At the end of these forearms, just the other side of a pair of delicate wrists, hung two enormous hands, veined and sculpted with extraordinary attention to detail.
"You're looking at my hands," Hatwell said.
"Oh, yeah."
I'd rather you didn't. I know I'm physically eccentric, but I really didn't stare."
"I think I can relate. I thought you were a little tense about playing with me because I'm, well, a bear."
Hatwell took a breath before speaking.
Actually, I kind of dig the concept, and this isn't the weirdest gig I ever played, if you want to know. One time I toured America with Tiny Tim, John Carradine, Pinky Lee, and Zippy the Chimp. We did like Hattawank, New Jersey, Fuckaduck, PA, Assawachee, Ohio, East Potato, and St. Bump, the whole circuit. The tour was booked by this mobbed-up guy, so of course what we played was a transcontinental series of, you should pardon the expression, policeman's balls. Mr. Tim headlined, but John Carradine did these sweeping versions of The Raven, Now Is the Winter of My Discotheque, and To Be or Not to Be. Then in his biggest ham-bone voice, he'd introduce the lovely Karina and her young charge. Karina had come out to saber dance in a spangly red costume, swinging Zippy in a circle in the air in the end of a rope the monkey had in his teeth. It was a buffalo show. After Zippy did his shtick, we'd get Pinky Lee in his check suit and derby hat, singing hi-ho-hee-hee, my name is Pinky Lee. And then Mr. Tim would make his entrance, showing all his strange-looking teeth and strumming on his ukulele, which was tuned to like R-sharp minor, telling us, in the key of G, gentlemen. And it would almost never fail. The wife of some cop or other would come flying across the room to put a flying lip lock on Tim, and we'd have to keep the cop husband from pulling out his rod and packing up his troubles right there. After that, we'd go out to a Chinese restaurant, and Zippy would get up on a table, pull down his pants, and moon the house before putting down a whole baked fish and a couple of noodle dishes. At the end of the tour, they found the mobbed-up guy who booked it in the trunk of his Buick Riviera with a long-nosed 22 in the base of his skull. I also did an episode of The Love Boat on a ship off Italy in the Mediterranean and dropped my whole paycheck playing cards with, of all people, Polly Bergen. This woman is a lethal weapon when she's got a deck of cards in her hands just in case you ever happen to run into her. Last week, I did 5 gigs in 2 days and lost money. I'm a working musician, Bear. You can't show me nothing new.
I don't know about you, but that's my kind of science fiction story. Zabor builds the story beautifully. I have to say that the book includes, among other things, among other virtues, unquestionably the most astonishing sex scene I have ever read in my life. The bear, be it understood, is attracted equally to female bears and female humans, but the problems of mating with a female human are non-trivial. I'm telling you, this is one unusual book, friends. Anyhow, it builds finally to the glorious moment in which the bear achieves his apotheosis and in essence creates his own love supreme, makes his own breakthrough. As any fool can tell you, how you make your breakthrough is you spend a lot of time on the road. And that's how the bear does it. He gets his own group together, solid cats, young geniuses, including Hatwell on piano, and they spend a lot of time on the road. And I'll just give you a short scene here. They've been on the bus, and they've just finished some extremely racist and sexist humor, which has appalled the bear, at least. And one of them has gotten up to change the subject by putting some music on the CD. Here we go. Garrett had selected a disc, and they could hear the anticipatory whir of the player above the road noise in the air conditioner. Coltrane came on.
"Oh, shit. God is in the house," Bostick said. "We have to cut this shit out."
"Our bassist ashamed us,"
Hatwell said and hung his head. It was Crescent, and they sat listening to Train's evolving solo, the gathering crests of his phrasing, the periodic releases as thematic waves broke smooth and ordered on the shore. "Well," said the bear, "there it is."
"Yeah, let's all play like that,"
Hatwell agreed.
"You ever see Train play live?"
Bostick asked the bear. "I was just a cub."
"And we hate you anyway. Tell us about it."
"Well, Jones took me down to Birdland on a leash." "Don't laugh. We used to play with the imagery. Once or twice Jones wore shades and acted blind, and I'd lead him. Our surrealist phase. You should have seen the double takes."
"Coltrane,"
Hatwell reminded him. "Well, it was pretty hard to hear over the drums once Elvin Jones got going."
"Come on, what was it like?"
"Something like being burned alive," said the bear, back there, seeing it. "I was still a cub, but I thought I'd experienced everything there was in the world, and Train was this enormous dose of, oh no, you haven't either. It was too much for me, but it left a deeper mark on me than anything else I've ever heard." "Uh-huh. Well, part of my problem was that I had to keep acting like your typical animule, and instead I kept moving to the music and watching Train. Jones kept yanking on the leash and telling me to keep the act up. You guys really interested in this?"
"Yeah."
"Well, what can I say? I remember thinking once or twice that there was nothing left for Train to do but levitate or burst into flames. Because the resources of music, as such, were over. Exhausted." We'll leave The Bear Comes Home with just the last 5 minutes of A Love Supreme, one of its exceedingly rare live recordings from sometime in 1964, Here are pianist McCoy Tyner, drummer Elvin Jones, and bassist Jimmy Garrison backing the great John Coltrane on the last 5 minutes of A Love Supreme.
Ce concert est donc terminé. Demain soir, vous pourrez retrouver John Coltrane
Comprenez, chers amis, que la musique ne se mesure pas au chronomètre, surtout l'art musical de John Coltrane. Il vient de nous donner le plus profond de lui-même. Permettez-lui de ne pas se répéter et de se reposer également.
And to be able to take a stranger into the head of a guy who can create music like that is no small accomplishment. I would love to give you Rafi Zabor's website, but he does not appear to have one for some reason or other. So the best I can come up with to thank him for creating this remarkable book, The Bear Comes Home, is to tell you that I just scored a copy of his second book, the autobiographical novel, I, Wabenzi. And I had to force myself to put the damn thing down and come out here and do this podcast. And now for something completely different. I cast about for the biggest musical non sequitur I could come up with. And this is what I found. It's by the great Todd Butler of Vancouver Island, and I'd like to dedicate this to my daughter, Terry Luana. It is called Dad.
When you need cash, Dad. When you borrowed the car and crashed,
Dad.
When your date gets drunk and breaks your heart, when your world falls apart, call your dad. Your homework is due,
Dad.
When you swear it wasn't you,
Dad.
He'll give you his heart and soul. Just don't touch that remote control. That's Dad's.
That's mine. Give it here.
Mom says no. You just can't go, you know that he will cave.
Just flash him those pearlies, and the man will be your slave. He's your dad,
Dad.
He will co-sign your loan,
Dad.
Then he will rarely ever phone. Will embarrass your date,
Dad.
With his jokes from 1958. So there's this Irishman, this German.
He's a jungle gym, he's a superhero, a cut above your average Joe.
Dad.
Happy, sad, it's hard for Dad to let his feelings show.
It's a family tradition
he learned so long ago from his dad.
Dad.
Now dads can't dance, don't have a clue about romance. You're wondering where babies come from.
Well,
Dad. Don't have a clue. Go ask your mom.
Go ask your mom.
His breath is bad and his jokes are old, but he is more precious than gold.
Dad.
He's your dad. Aren't you glad? He's your dad, it's Father's Day.
Aren't you glad that he's your dad?
Aren't you glad? He's your dad, it's Father's Day.
It's Father's Day.
Aren't you glad? He's your dad, it's Father's Day.
All the dad.
Aren't you glad? He's your dad, it's Father's Day.
Aren't you glad? He's your dad.
Aren't you glad? He's your dad, it's Father's Day.
Dad! I can't, that sounds retarded, Dad.
All right, I selected that track with blatant ironic intent, which will shortly become clear, because now we're going to discuss another science fiction novel by a non-science fiction writer whose central theme is fatherhood, but unlike Todd, this author manages to approach the topic without the slightest taint of humor or playfulness or
hope. Indeed, in the future he gives us, any trace of humor or playfulness or hope would be obscene. Well, when the book is ideally suited for that friend of yours with clinical depression who is desperate for someone to agree with him that everything everywhere sucks, you know you must be talking about serious literature, where that belief is an entrance requirement. Sure enough, our next writer is as far as possible from both a science fiction writer or a first novelist like Raffi Zabor. He is Cormac McCarthy, born July 20th, 1933, in Providence, Rhode Island, which would depress me, and I was born in a place called Plainview. He is a Pulitzer Prize-winning American novelist who has authored 10 novels in the Southern Gothic, Western, and, it says here in Wikipedia, post-apocalyptic genres. He has also written plays and screenplays. Literary critic Harold Bloom has named him as one of the four major American novelists of his time, along with Thomas Pynchon, Don DeLillo, and Philip Roth. He is frequently compared by modern reviewers to William Faulkner and sometimes to Herman Melville. I read further in Wikipedia and found McCarthy now lives in New Mexico, sort of north of Santa Fe, with his wife Jennifer and their son John. He guards his privacy closely and rarely gives interviews. In one of his very few interviews with The Times, McCarthy is described as a gregarious loner, unquote, and reveals that he is not a fan of authors that do not, quote, deal with issues of life and death, unquote, citing Henry James and Marcel Proust as examples. "I don't understand them," he said. "To me, that's not literature. A lot of writers who are considered good, I consider strange," unquote. McCarthy remains active in the academic community of Santa Fe and spends much of his time at the Santa Fe Institute, which was founded by his friend, physicist Murray Gell-Mann. Talk show host Oprah Winfrey chose McCarthy's 2006 novel, The Road, as the April 2007 selection for her book club. In addition, McCarthy agreed to sit down for his first ever television interview, which aired on the Oprah Winfrey show on June 5th, 2007. The interview took place in the library of the Santa Fe Institute. McCarthy told Oprah that he does not know any writers and much prefers the company of scientists. During the interview, he related several stories illustrating the degree of outright poverty he has endured at times during his career as a writer. He also spoke about the experience of fathering a young child at an advanced age and how his now 8-year-old son was the inspiration for The Road, thank you, Wikipedia. Well, first let me say that I agree absolutely with anyone who wants to talk about the grinding poverty that is the lot of the writer. I just love watching TV shows and movies. Whenever there's a character who's a writer, he lives in a mansion, he has servants, and he's driving a Jag. That might accurately describe something less than 0.1% of the writers on the planet. The rest of us are all broke. Anyhow, Santa Fe area is the home of George R. R. Martin. Roger Zelazny used to live there, you know, it's a Fred Sagerhagen territory. I thought perhaps a writer of Cormac McCarthy's stature from that part of the world might have produced a good science fiction novel by a non-science fiction writer. Well, one of us had hope. Here are excerpts from a letter I wrote to a colleague whose permission to use his name I do not have, so please don't guess. "Hermano, are you a fan of this here now Cormac McCarthy? I was just given The Road for my birthday. At last, Joanna Russ finally has an imitator, though I'm certain he's never heard of her in his life. It would be a science fiction novel if it weren't literature. Instead, it's a post-apocalyptic novel destined to become his masterpiece, according to the back cover. The New York Times Book Review called it, quote, vivid, eloquent, the most readable of his works, and consistently brilliant in its imagining of the posthumous condition of nature and civilization, unquote. The L.A. Times called it, quote, one of his best, unquote. Eloquent, I'll give him. It is constructed of beautiful sentences, connected in powerful paragraphs. And there are some extremely moving father-son moments. I'll bet money McCarthy met someone young enough to give him a new son 7 or 8 years back. Note, I only use these powers for good. They are what kept me reading that and his rep. But I paid dearly for it. I rate it the worst SF by a civilian I've read in a decade or two, up there with Margaret Atwood. There are exactly 2 women in the whole book, both one-page cartoons, one an inexplicable monster and one a cliché. Stylistically, it has to be great literature, because it has absolutely no structure at all, no shape, no attempt at pace, no spine or direction or measurement. McCarthy writes until he feels like stopping, comes back the next day, skips two lines, and does it again. The paragraph is the height of his thought's evolution, its largest unit of meaning. There are no chapters, sections, volumes, parts, blocks, or other groupings. In that sense, the book could be described as relentless. And in every other sense, too. It is too pessimistic for despair, too apathetic for surrender, too sad to weep. Its premise is that after the bombs fall, there will be exactly two decent humans left briefly on the planet, quote, carrying the fire, unquote, of kindness and humanity, and that they will unquestionably fail after being tortured as long and cruelly as possible. In McCarthy's ficton, the bombs will fall. Well, maybe the disaster won't be nuclear because the protagonist doesn't seem worried about radiation or wind patterns, but something horrible happens. All I can tell you for sure is there will be bright lights in the night, after which billions will swiftly die, and the rest of us will be left briefly alive to suffer drawn-out agony and terror. But not one single vestige of civilization will be even momentarily preserved or resurrected anywhere on Earth ever. The Internet in particular, specifically designed for this very event, will fail utterly. There'll be no radio of any kind, no electric power of any nature anywhere, no enclaves of civilization or attempts at one, not one vestige of social order of any kind, just selfish individuals. Nearly everyone dies soon, but not before scavenging and wasting all the gas, food, batteries, weapons, ammo, etc., leaving the few thousand or 100,000 survivors in the Stone Age surrounded by useless relics of technology. Nobody remembers how to plant a seed or even find edible plants. Once the last can is gone, it's game over. Building even a lean-to would make you a target for cannibals. Better to hide in the bush, under a tarp. In this nearly empty world, a dying man with no name, our hero, finds himself left alone with his very young son, also unnamed, not because his nameless wife is taken by radiation or illness or hunger, mind you. No. Once it's clear civilization is over, she simply looks him in the eye and tells him the kid is his problem. She's committing suicide, because he can't protect her, obviously, so she and the boy will, of course, inevitably be raped and killed and eaten if she sticks around, and she'd rather not wait. He can do as he likes. Just like Russ's anti-heroine in We Who Are About To, she'd rather die than protect her child, or trust a man, rather cut her throat than hope. Hard to figure, because Dad is a saint, and rather competent, and absolutely the only non-devil left on Earth besides the boy. For some reason, he remembers this witch fondly. For nearly 300 pages, he and the boy walk across America, for no reason ever stated, there's nothing at the coast to strive for, and not once do they encounter another human being who is not murderous and bestial. The closest they come is a doddering, dying ancient too feeble to assault them, but he does try to steal all their food and supplies, even though he clearly has no chance. He has hope. Sometimes they hide beside the road and watch passing parades of the strong, wearing armor made of car parts, carrying swords made of plowshares, dragging a harem of chained baby machines slash cooks, followed closely by a reeking pack of chained catamites slash food animals. The world is divided into the strong, pussy, and dinner. I can remember all three of the times in the book that something good briefly happens, flickers of, well, not hope, but momentary respite. Well, nobody's perfect. Spoiler warning, here I go on to give away the ending. You've been warned. Dad spends the whole book trying not to let on to the kid that everything everywhere is irretrievably forever fucked, including them, but by the end of the book, the boy has figured it out. The book ends 5 pages after Dad finally coughs up his guts and dies in the night. One paragraph later, the first solo male in the book wanders by and happens to also be the first non-cannibal. He takes the boy home to his wife, but she immediately begins teaching him the right way to worship God, and we know his will not be a happy childhood. The end. Can someone explain to me why Mr. McCarthy has not killed himself? or at least why people seem to enjoy reading him. It's quite clear why critics love him, but who else reads this stuff and then doesn't sound the alarm for the rest of us? It just seems so perverse to me to create such a strong father-son love story while constantly reminding the reader on every page in every sentence that all love is pointless and doomed like everything else. Well, I guess that's why I haven't heard from the Pulitzer people yet. Signed, Spider. My unnamed colleague wrote back in part, "Well, now tell me what you really thought of the book. I'm no fan of No Country for Old Men, book or very faithful movie. I started Blood Meridian after I read that, but it was too mean, pointless, and bloody, which is really saying something, as I'm not necessarily against mean, pointless, and bloody in the book. But this one made Deadwood seem like a Gene Autry singing cowboy musical co-starring Shirley Temple. You should be reading Dean Koontz. Over the last few years, he's moved his central theme of hope front and center in his books to the point of preachiness, something you've been flirting with lately, too. This isn't a criticism, just an observation. You guys have a lot in common. In his newest one, which I finished a few days ago, he explicitly attacks what he sees as the critical darlings of despair, leaving great big clues that he detests Vonnegut and Pynchon, among others. Probably Cormac McCarthy, too. He creates villains dedicated to evil for the sake of evil, puts his protagonists in terrible situations, but they always cling to hope, and in the end, hope triumphs. Not always convincingly. If you decide to read this new one, I should warn you there can be such a thing as too much hope. To the point that he sacrifices believability in the ending, just pulls the rabbit of hope out of his hat and leaves it at that. But I have to say, he keeps me turning the pages. Now, fair go, mate. Maybe you like books in which depression is a central element. I've been clinically depressed myself. I'm not trying to mock it or make fun of it. When you're in that headspace, it makes an awful lot of sense. And in all fairness to Mr. McCarthy, I read some of Raffi Zabor. I should read him a little of his, give you an idea of what I'm talking about. As I say, it's hard to know where to start, where to stop, because it's all basically one enormous chapter. So I'll just jump in. Page 105. They'd had no food and little sleep in 5 days, and in this condition, on the outskirts of a small town, they came upon a once grand house sighted on a rise above the road. The boy stood holding his hand. The snow was largely melted on the macadam and in the south-facing fields and woods. They stood there. The plastic bags over their feet had long since worn through, and their feet were wet and cold. The house was tall and stately, with white Doric columns across the front, a porte cochere at the side, a gravel drive that curved up through a field of dead grass. The windows were oddly intact.
"What is this place, Papa?"
"Shh! Let's just stand here and listen." There was nothing. The wind rustling the dead roadside bracken, a distant creaking, door or shutter. "I think we should take a look."
"Papa, let's not go up there."
"It's okay."
"I don't think we should go up there."
"It's okay. We have to take a look." They approached slowly up the drive, no tracks in the random patches of melting snow, a tall hedge of dead privet, an ancient bird's nest lodged in the dark wicker of it. They stood in the yard studying the facade, the handmade brick of the house kilned out of the dirt it stood on, the peeling paint hanging in long dry sleevings down the columns and from the buckled soffits, a lamp that hung from a long chain overhead. The boy clung to him as they climbed the steps. One of the windows was slightly open, and a cord ran from it and across the porch to vanish in the grass. He held the boy's hand, and they crossed the porch. Chattel slaves had once trod those boards, bearing food and drink on silver trays. They went to the window and looked in.
"What if there's someone here, Papa?"
"There's no one here."
"We should go, Papa."
"We've got to find something to eat. We have no choice."
"We could find something somewhere else."
"It's going to be all right. Come on." He took the pistol from his belt and tried the door. It swung slowly in on its great brass hinges. They stood listening. Then they stepped into a broad foyer floored in a domino of black and white marble tiles. A broad staircase ascending. Fine Morris paper on the walls, water-stained and sagging. The plaster ceiling was bellied in great swags, and the yellow dental molding was bowed and sprung from the upper walls. To the left through the doorway stood a large walnut buffet in what must have been the dining room. The doors and the drawers were gone, but the rest of it was too large to burn. They stood in the doorway. Piled in a windrow in one corner of the room was a great heap of clothing. Clothes and shoes. Belts. Coats. Blankets and old sleeping bags. He would have ample time later to think about that. The boy hung onto his hand. He was terrified. They crossed the foyer to the room on the far side and walked in and stood. A great hall of a room with ceilings twice the height of the doors. A fireplace with raw brick showing where the wooden mantel and surround had been pried away and burned. There were mattresses and bedding arranged on the floor in front of the hearth.
"Papa,"
the boy whispered.
"Shh,"
he said. The ashes were cold. Some blackened pots stood about. He squatted on his heels and picked one up and smelled it and put it back. He stood and looked out the window. Gray, trampled grass. Gray snow. The cord that came through the window was tied to a brass bell, and the bell was fixed in a rough wooden jig that had been nailed to the window molding. He held the boy's hand, and they went down a narrow back hallway into the kitchen. Trash piled everywhere. A rust-stained sink. Smell of mold and excrement. They went on into the adjoining small room, perhaps a pantry. In the floor of this room was a door or hatch, and it was locked with a large padlock made of stacked steel plates. He stood looking at it.
"Papa," the boy said, "we should go. Papa."
"There's a reason this is locked." The boy pulled at his hand. He was almost in tears.
"Papa,"
he said, "we've got to eat."
"I'm not hungry, Papa, I'm not."
"We need to find a pry bar or something." They pushed out through the back door, the boy hanging on to him. He shoved the pistol in his belt and stood looking out over the yard. There was a brick walkway and the twisted and wiry shape of what once had been a row of boxwoods. In the yard was an old iron harrow propped up on piers of stacked brick, and someone had wedged between the rails of it a 40-gallon cast-iron cauldron of the kind once used for rendering hogs. Underneath were the ashes of a fire and blackened billets of wood. Off to one side, a small wagon with rubber tires. All these things he saw and did not see. At the far side of the yard was an old wooden smokehouse and a tool shed. He crossed, half dragging the child, and went sorting through tools standing in a barrel under the shed roof. He came up with a long-handled spade and hefted it in his hand. "Come on," he said. Back in the house, he chopped at the wood around the hasp staple and finally jammed the blade under the staple and pried it up. It was bolted through the wood, and the whole thing came up lock and all. He kicked the blade of the shovel under the edge of the boards and stopped and got his lighter out. Then he stood on the tang of the shovel and raised the edge of the hatch and leaned and got a hold of it.
"Papa,"
the boy whispered. He stopped.
"Listen to me," he said. "Just stop it. We're starving. Do you understand?"
Then he raised the hatch door and swung it over and let it down on the floor behind.
"Just wait here," he said. "I'm going with you."
"I thought you were scared."
"I am scared."
"Okay, just stay close behind me."
He started down the rough wooden steps. He ducked his head and then flicked the lighter and swung the flame out over the darkness like an offering. Coldness and damp, an ungodly stench. The boy clutched at his coat. He could see part of a stone wall, clay floor, an old mattress, darkly stained. He crouched and stepped down again and held out the light. Huddled against the back wall were naked people, male and female, all trying to hide, shielding their faces with their hands. On the mattress lay a man with his legs gone to the hip and the stumps of them blackened and burnt. The smell was hideous.
"Jesus,"
he whispered. Then one by one they turned and blinked in the pitiful light.
"Help us," they whispered. "Please help us."
"Christ," he said. "Oh, Christ." He turned and grabbed the boy. "Hurry," he said. "Hurry." He dropped the lighter. No time to look. He pushed the boy up the stairs.
"Help us," they called.
"Hurry."
A bearded face appeared blinking at the foot of the stairs. "Please," he called. "Please."
"Hurry. For God's sake, hurry." He shoved the boy through the hatch and sent him sprawling. He stood and got hold of the door and swung it over and let it slam down, and he turned to grab the boy, but the boy had gotten up and was doing his little dance of terror.
"For the love of God, will you come on?"
he hissed. But the boy was pointing out the window, and when he looked, he went cold all over. Coming across the field toward the house were four bearded men and two women. He grabbed the boy by the hand.
"Christ," he said. Run! Run!
I reckon that'll do. I'm sorry. Everybody's entitled to their opinion. For my money, science fiction without hope in it is an oxymoron. I don't think you can have science fiction without hope in it, almost by definition. Science fiction is the literature that assumes there's going to be a future and that there'll be at least someone left who cares about it. Now, I presume Mr. McCarthy would argue that he was never attempting anything so juvenile as a science fiction novel. He was writing serious literature in the post-apocalyptic genre. But by any other name, that's science fiction. And he's said to be friends with a lot of scientists. I would have thought he'd have more faith in what it is they do for a living. Anyhow, it's time to go. Let me play you out with a minute and a half or less of a song by one of the most depressed songwriters who ever lived. She's really terrific. If you don't know her, check out her work. Her name is Dori Previn, and I wish I had her permission to podcast this entire song because it's one of my favorites. I don't, but I'm going to give you the last minute and a half and hope she won't mind. It's from a wonderful album called Mythical Kings and Iguanas. It's a song I've returned to again and again over the years when, like every other human being, I have my own periods of black despair and clinical depression. Here to play us out is the great Dori Previn and The Game.
I watch the game, and if I play, I know I'll go for broke. It must be go for broke. The game is fixed. It's just a funny, foolish, never-ending joke. A never-ending joke. A never-ending joke. The dealer winks and beckons with a toothless, taunting grin. I know I cannot win. I know I cannot win. The game is fixed. Okay. All right. Okay. All right. Okay. All right. God damn it. Deal me in.
As always, Spider on the Web number 25 is being podcast under Creative Commons license. No derivatives, non-commercial, share alike. Your donations to spiderrobinson.com/podcast.html are much appreciated. Next week, readings from the Lifehouse Trilogy, available now in better bookstores everywhere. See you then. Oh, and please don't forget that the best bookstores will still have a few copies of Tor's paperback edition of the new novel, Variable Star, by Robert A. Heinlein and Spider Robinson.